Chapter 80. Versailles gave birth to Hitler. Wilson had grown bitter and ailing as he realized his 14 points had been permanently discarded. He had been unable to change anything in the final outcome of the treaty. He returned home a broken man. Lloyd George, who a few months before was talking about squeezing Germany dry, was now uncomfortable with the results. He felt France was getting too much and could become a threat to British trade. British policy was to keep all European countries weak and not to make any of the stronger. English delegate Harold Nicholson, who had previously displayed an unusual degree of conscience, recorded his views of the treaty. "Reading this treaty makes me sicker and sicker. The reparation clauses are the greatest crime. They were written in for the sole purpose of pleasing the House of Commons and are impossible to implement. If I were a German, I would not sign. This treaty does not give them hope for the present or the future. It is sheer madness, and the worst of it is that these Huns would have accepted anything that was reasonable. When we made peace," pages 203 to 204. Nicholson noted in his diary. "Tuesday, June 17, 1919, the Council of Ten allows a Turkish delegation to present their case. It is scandalous that the Turks have the right to argue their case while the Germans are guarded in cages at Versailles. Wednesday, June 18. It is uncertain whether the Germans will sign. The less optimistic believe they are going to refuse to sign, that we will advance on the Rhine and they will sign under pressure. The pessimists believe they will hand over power to the Bolsheviks as Karoly has done and we will have a red Central Europe. If they do, it will be our fault. Tuesday, June 24. People here are relieved that the Weimar Assembly has authorized the treaty to be signed by their emissaries, but rather embarrassed by the sinking of the German Navy. It gives us the appearance of being worse than we are, and absurd. When we made peace," page 222 to 225. Even such enemies of Germany as Marshal Smuts of South Africa and Lenin were acknowledging for their own reasons the inequity of the treaty. Said Nicholson, after seeing Smuts, "I had dinner with Smuts. He has finally consented to sign the treaty, but only after protesting and against his conscience. Lenin declared, a peace of usurers and executioners has been imposed on Germany. This country has been plundered and dismembered. All its means of survival were taken away. This is an incredible bandit's peace. Lenin should certainly know." June 28, 1919 was the Allies' big day. The Royal Palace of Versailles had been refurbished for the occasion. Clemenceau was there sitting beneath an old inscription, "The King governs by himself." He was, recalled Nicholson, a shrunken individual with sallow complexion. Clemenceau ordered, "Bring in the Germans." The Germans assigned to this humiliating task were Dr. Bell and Dr. Mueller, two obscure political figures. Clemenceau said dryly, "Gentlemen, the session is opened. We are here to sign the peace treaty." No other word was uttered. In deathly silence, the German envoys signed, then the Allies. "The session is closed," said Clemenceau. The guards who had brought the Germans in escorted them out. No one had the civility of talking to them or even shaking their hands. Contrary to all precedents in the annals of diplomacy, the German emissaries were treated like criminals or lepers. Nicholson recalled, "Everything was horrible. We were later served champagne courtesy of the taxpayers." A few years later, Churchill would absolve the Germans and their leaders of deliberate wrongdoing. The execution of this vast plan for war was deemed necessary by the German leaders not only for the victory of Germany but for its very security and survival. They felt no other option when the Russians mobilized. The conditions of the Franco-Russian alliance placed them in the possibility of a war on two fronts against superior forces. Their sincerity cannot be doubted. World Crisis, Volume 4, page 434. Politicians' actions seldom reflect their words. Churchill, like Lloyd George and Lansing, had stated before the treaty was signed that its contents would ensure new hatred and conflict, a new war more devastating than the last. Yet, with full knowledge of the likely consequences, they all signed. The peace treaty was in fact the vengeance treaty. It was therefore logical it would create a strong reaction in Germany. The clause on collective guilt had the effect of uniting the whole German people, from extreme left to extreme right. The socialist president of the German Reichstag, Herr Fehrenbach, had foreseen its results. The sufferings engendered by this treaty will create in Germany a generation whose sole aim from birth will be to break the chains of a slavery that was imposed on them, Benoist Mädchen, Volume 1, page 334. The question was now, who was going to break the chains? Germany looked for an avenger to smash the Treaty of Vengeance. The avenger could belong to the conventional right and left wings of German politics or any other establishment entities, whether financial, military, or religious. The socialists were numerous, but had proved themselves indecisive and cowardly. They had been saved from communist annihilation only by Noske's iron will and fist. Now that the danger had passed, they execrated and rejected their savior, and had fallen back into their drab and mediocre ways. For 14 years they would play musical chairs with one another with petty expediency. Always uninspiring, they would fail to motivate and they would fail to lead. The socialist fear of ideals and greatness prevented anyone to emerge to any position of real leadership. Everybody was leveled down to a common denominator of mediocrity, the very essence of Marxism. The middle classes, bourgeois and industrial groups were just as craven as the socialists. The fear of losing whatever material possessions they had was all-pervasive and paralyzed the right. Both the left and right had fear and mediocrity in common. They had no faith in anything except the basest of material considerations. The German people were looking for inspired leadership and found frightened sheep instead. Above all, there was a total absence of anyone with guts. Along with the politics of mediocrity came the usual corruption, confusion, and demoralization, the mainstays of democratic regimes. The Weimar mediocrities would misgovern and mismanage their way until 1933, when Germany had virtually ground to a halt. The German people withdrew its support from the grubby democratic dealers, who were now the object of loathing and contempt. A transcending unity was being forged, despite the combined opposition of the left and the right. Instinctively, people knew that the press and the conventional political parties did not represent them, they were instead an integral part of the cancer that was destroying their country. The right wore the mantle of patriotism but never went beyond words to exercise their patriotism, while the left was captive of nebulous and incoherent Marxist mouthings. The savior of Germany would sweep aside all these contradictory and outdated factors. He would unite the workers in partnership with the industrialists on the premise that work is the real wealth and capital of a nation. Class war only benefited professional trade unionists living off the workers and the capitalist monopolies, both committed to the status quo, against progress. The Weimar mediocrities had failed to free Germany from the shackles of the peace treaty, which was the one issue uniting all Germans. They had failed to gauge Germany's mood. People were willing to sacrifice themselves for the high purpose of saving Germany, but no one was willing to fight and die for the sake of a pork chop or a pair of socks. The Weimar politicians were engrossed in materialism and just could not conceive of principles and ideals as a motivating factor. In fact, they feared the popular will. The mass of non-issues which were being presented at election times or filling the newspapers were designed to diffuse popular resolve and energy. People's aspirations were sidetracked into dead-end roads. People's attempts to raise themselves above mediocre conditions were thwarted by the apostles of mediocrity. In human affairs, people yearn for an ideal to believe in. Religious or political figures who fail to fulfill people's aspirations are destined for oblivion. It was when Germany had sunk to its lowest level of political mismanagement, when corruption and depravity were foisted on the nation from the top, when all seemed hopeless, that the people experienced their greatest need for regeneracy. Whoever had the qualities to answer the popular call would find the power to restore Germany's freedom and honor. Collective impotence would be swept away by the man who would truly embody popular dynamism. He would fight for national honor, social justice, and class cooperation. Workers and industrialists all belonged to the same nation, to the same economic entity. Class war was an error against nature, a cynical exploitation of the productive elements of the nation. It had to be replaced by a genuine collaboration, with all parties sharing in the social profits. All work and all workers would have to be respected. The savior of Germany would be not only a nationalist but also a socialist, a patriot and a defender of social justice. He would not be trapped in a web of Marxist dialectics pitting members of the same nation against one another. He would gather all the energy of all the people for the benefit of social and national unity and for the benefit of all the people. This man who both would be a nationalist and socialist idealist, did he exist in Germany of 1919? He was nowhere to be seen. There were mediocre politicians, cogs in unrepresentative party machines of nationalists without leadership or revolutionaries controlled by aliens and railroaded into murderous uprisings for the benefit of alien interests. Yet this man existed, and his time had come.